Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Each month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Every once in a while, I read a book that dramatically revises the way I look at an event or a question. Today's guest, Robert Donnier, has written just such a book. Bob is an expert in the Balkans and the author of several studies of the region, and has written a new book, a superb biography of Radovan Karadzic, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs for much of the 1990s. Published by Cambridge University Press, the book uses a wealth of new sources to track Karadzic's evolution from tolerance to racism, his relationship from Slobodan Milosevic, and the emergence of mass violence in Bosnia. It's a book everyone interested in the subject should read, and I'm really looking forward to talking with him today. So, with that, Bob, thanks for being with us on New Books in Genocide Studies, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly. Good to be with you.
So, why don't we start just by asking you to talk a little bit about who you are. What's your background? How did you get interested in the Balkans? How did you end up becoming an academic?
I am an historian by training. I got a PhD in history at the University of Michigan way back in 1976. And from the beginning of my career, was interested in what was then Yugoslavia and the way in which Yugoslavia went through the process of becoming a more European, more modern society. So as a part of that, I spent some time in Sarajevo, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, in 1974-75, doing dissertation research for a previous book that I wrote. The evolution of my career from that point was rather indirect. I spent some time working for Merrill Lynch and then was to doing academic work only after about 2000. But in the meantime, got, of course, very concerned and interested in the events in the war in the former Yugoslavia, specifically Bosnia, that raged from 1992 to 1995. And that indeed is the origins of the book that we're talking about today.
So can I ask, most of our listeners are probably old enough to remember this. What was your experience like watching the war as it unfolded? What do you remember about observing the war in the 1990s and how you felt about it then?
Well, at that time, the war, I think, came through the media as one of two sort of major developments in the region. And the first interpretation that you got from the media, I think, was that this was a war of all against all, a spontaneous eruption of violence amongst people who never got along and had always engaged in one another, in violence against one another. And the other image that came through was of a long-standing conspiracy on the part of the Serbs of the former Yugoslavia to build an expansive Serb state and to eliminate all those peoples and actors who stood in their way. That is still the way I believe those two interpretations, I think, are still dominant in the minds of most people who watch the conflict from a distance through the media. And so my response to that at the time, and continues to be today, is that neither interpretation is anywhere near an accurate representation of what went on. And so my understanding of the conflict, from knowing the region and from having spent a great deal of time studying the sources and so on, is that this was an event of relatively recent political history, which had its origins in the actual breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. And that was the source of the path to war.
And so let me press you a little bit more. How did you feel about what was your own emotional response to that kind of reporting that was going on?
Well, I was deeply concerned and upset about the misrepresentations that I saw going on in the media, particularly the misrepresentations of the history of the region. Yeah, that was, in fact, the motivation for a book that I wrote with a co-author at the University of Michigan, John Fine, which we published in 1994, called Bosnia and Herzegovina, A Tradition Betrayed. Mm. In this book, we tried to show that the more dominant history of Bosnia and Herzegovina was one of coexistence and tolerance among these people, and that the outbursts of violence were aberrations within that history, often cited by the intervention of outside forces, whether they were neighboring outside forces, such as from Serbia and Croatia, or more distant outside actors, such as the Habsburg monarchy in the earlier period, and other imperial interlopers.
So let's skip ahead, I guess, a little bit. Why did you decide then to write a biography of Karadzic?
The biography of Karadzic came to my mind as almost a last resort to what we're trying to do for a number of years. Starting in 1997, I was called as a witness in a number of trials at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague, to provide historical background to events that were alleged in the various indictments. And so I had an opportunity through about 15 of these trials to get to see, and in a few cases, rather nominally at least, to get to know some of the people who were accused of the most heinous war crime that time. And I had the consistent impression from meeting these people or seeing them in court and watching them behave over the course of the time that I was in there, that these were, in fact, rather ordinary or, let's say, unremarkable people.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that every one of these folks was a monster, was a psychopath, was a crazed killer, simply didn't bear itself out as I watched the room. So I felt there was a need to understand at least a couple of the key players and how they came to, how these rather, let's say, unremarkable people came to commit these heinous acts. And that, to me, was the most important part of the history of the war that had yet to be explained. And when I had to testify in Karadzic's case in 2010, and to spend, it was about 24 hours altogether, courtroom time in exchanges, verbal exchanges with him, that was what sealed my decision to seek to write a biography of Karadzic based on the documentation that I had access to and our encounters in the courtroom, which enabled me to see how he reacted, how he behaved when confronted with some of these allegations.
Can you say a little bit about, you mentioned the documentation for the trials. Can you say something about what kind of sources you had available and how you secured access to those sources?
Yes. The sources that I used were assembled originally by the Office of the Prosecutor at the Kirby in order to document the crimes that the prosecutors alleged were committed by the accused. Now, that corpus of documents grew immensely over time. It's today something like 9 million documents in the custody of the tribunal, either in copy or in original. Hmm. And so I was asked to review some of this documentation, obviously a small, very small portion of it, in preparation for my testimony about the historical background of the conflict. And each time that I testified in a case, I was given a new, different corpus of documents to go over. Hmm. Now, were given to me under the presumption of confidentiality. However, over time, as they were admitted into evidence in various cases, they entered the public domain so that I was able then to use them to write a history or a biography of Karadzic, as well as to have initially reviewed them as a part of preparation for my testimony. This amounted to a substantial body of documentation, but also was probably the most important selection of documents from this enormous collection, had assembled. And that just gave me an insight and sense of storyline to follow as I was able to then convert that into a book about Karadzic's life.
Hmm. Is it so? So, although I started life as a Habsburg historian, I guess, well, not started life, but started academic life, but I've kind of left that a little bit. Is it a fair reading of the historiography to say that there's a flood of books that come out in the 90s, and then actually there's not been that many examinations of the war in the last decade or a little more than that? Is that a fair summary?
I think it is fair. I think that the mountain of volumes that came out in the 1990s, largely by journalists or people who had firsthand experience and observation of the war, was actually extremely helpful in understanding the nature of the war and what led to it. But from that point on, I think the attention focused more upon the trials at the tribunal rather than on the war itself, in terms of, let's say, public awareness of the region. And it's only in the last few years that we've seen, I think, some very fine studies based on some of the documentation that the Hague Tribunal brought together and some of the other documents that have been made available by the various governments and players and actors in the war, that we really started to see another generation of studies of the war start to come out and again revise our understanding of how the conflict developed.
Well, let's turn to the book and let's start, if you don't mind, by having me ask you to introduce us to Radovan Karadzic. Where was he born? What kind of childhood did he have? What can you say about him before he becomes politically important and influential?
Well, Radovan Karadzic is a fascinating individual in that his childhood, while it was a very difficult childhood, and his early adulthood, really had nothing spectacular about them. He was not noted for being a particularly cruel person or violent person. In fact, he seemed to have charmed those people who came to know him in the first 45 years of his life. He was born in July of 1945, coincidentally 47 days after I was born. And so he grew up in those immediate post-war years in Yugoslavia, which were extremely difficult economically. He was from a peasant family in Montenegro, in a very small mountainous part of the former Yugoslavia. And at age 15, moved to Sarajevo, which then became his adopted hometown. Got an education as a medical doctor and specialized training as a psychiatrist. So during this socialist period, he distinguished himself by being a respectable professional person who, although he certainly engaged in some questionable practices financially as a psychiatrist, nevertheless maintained a practice at the local hospital in Sarajevo, seems to have had friends from all walks of life, from all ethnic and religious communities, and to have been a constructive member of the community. All that changed in when he turned 45 in 1990, just as Yugoslavia was breaking up and the first multi-party elections were held. And with no political background whatsoever, Radovan Karadzic, because of his extensive network of friends and the high regard that he was held by the Serb nationalists in particular, was selected as president of the newly founded Democratic Party. And that launched him on a career as the head of the Bosnian Serbs that lasted actually until 1996. And that meant that he was in charge, or certainly the leader of the Bosnian Serbs throughout the war and throughout the atrocities and violence that were committed by Bosnian Serbs during those 5 years.
So let's take a step back briefly, and then I'll return to him as a politician. So many in our audience are familiar with the war in Bosnia, but some are not. So could you, and I know I'm asking you an impossible question, but I'll do it anyway. Could you maybe summarize fairly quickly the situation in Bosnia and Yugoslavia at the late 1980s and kind of set the stage for the rest of our discussion?
Yes, the story, I think, starts with or can be started with the death of Tito in 1980. He was a figure that was revered in the former Yugoslavia, and he was really the only political leader of great influence in that time. With his death, the ethnic tension, which had been very largely subdued from the period from 1945 to 1980, began to resurface, and the state itself, the federal government of Yugoslavia, was subjected to considerable rivalry and eventually, to during the electoral process, divisions among the ethnic groups. So in 1990, when elections were held throughout the country, nationalists came to power. And these nationalists of all groups turned out, unsurprisingly, to be incapable of working together and rather turned to undermining one another and, in the process, undermining the state. The strongest group to emerge from this was, in fact, the Serbs of Yugoslavia, because largely they were the ones who were able to capture the resources of the federal army, the Yugoslav People's Army, and that gave them a near monopoly on force as Yugoslavia was breaking apart. And indeed, it was the Yugoslav People's Army that prosecuted, first of all, the war in Slovenia in June and July of 1991, and then in Croatia deploy the remainder in 1991, and finally in Bosnia and Herzegovina in 1992 and onward.
And so, in particular in Bosnia, what is there a sense in the Serbian community in, say, the mid-80s that there position is threatened, that there's a need to work toward autonomy? What kind of history do they remember, and what lessons do they learn from it in the mid-80s as opposed to the early 90s?
That's a very good question, and the answer to it really isn't known for sure. It's very clear that the political elite amongst the Serbs believed and promoted the notion that Serbs were being discriminated against, were threatened, and in fact had been the victims of genocide, not only during World War II, but also in the latter years of socialist Yugoslavia. So that there certainly was genuine fear on the part of these political elites that they were being marginalized and that their constituents were being discriminated against. But it appears, anyway, that the Serb population as a whole was very slow to come over to this viewpoint. And until really quite late in the process, continued to support the multi-ethnic League of Communists and to at least retain some support for the notion of a multinational Yugoslavia of equality of people. So the story of the late 1980s really is one of Slobodan Milosevic as the president of Serbia and eventually Yugoslavia promoting an ideology that emphasized fear and victimhood on the part of the Serbs. And that was the thing that mobilized both the Serbs and the Yugoslav People's Army into launching these, what were viewed always as defensive or protective actions against those other peoples in Yugoslavia, and most specifically the Croats and the Muslims of Bosnia and Herzegovina, who are today known as Bosniaks.
And you mentioned Milosevic. Can you just really briefly kind of summarize who he was and how he came to be the leader of that nationalist sentiment?
Yes. Milosevic was born in Serbia, a Serb who was actually of no particular consequence until he was mentored into the League of Communists and into the business, financial business, both as a banker and as a head of a gas company, by senior people in the party within Serbia. He distinguished himself in 1987 by siding openly with Serbs on a trip down to Kosovo, which has a largely Albanian population. And from that point on, broke all the rules of leadership, which said that such conflicts should always be ironed out within the party, and became a populist hero who was mobilizing this sense of anger, frustration, and discrimination on the part of Serbs. So he became known as a proponent of Serb control of Yugoslavia, or Serb domination by some other means of all the policies in the area.
And one of the really remarkable parts of your story is the depth with which you're able to consider and kind of discuss the relationship between Karadzic and Milosevic. So where does that relationship stand in at the point where Karadzic emerges as the leader of the Bosnian Serbs?
The source of our knowledge about that relationship is largely in the telephone intercepts, the interceptions that were made by the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina on virtually every telephone call that took place between the two of them. So So we know, for example, that the two of them met for the first time in 1990, that Milosevic supported Karadzic as the president of the Serb Democratic Party, and that Karadzic viewed himself as a follower of Milosevic and readily accepted his mentorship.
Mm-hmm.
That lasted until about the fall of 1991, when Karadzic began to get control of things in Bosnia on his own, at which point the two of them began to drift apart. And those tensions between them increased throughout the war to the point where they, first of all, were barely speaking, and second, eventually, in 1995, Milosevic outmaneuvered Karadzic and essentially took over himself the leadership of the peace negotiating team that was to represent the Bosnian Serbs in at the Dayton Peace Talks in 1995. So that relationship really evolved over time from being one of mentorship and then close collaboration to one of considerable tension, rivalry, and eventually Milosevic purging Karadzic of at least this portion of his responsibility and taking him over himself.
So I've got to come back to that rather remarkable comment you made at the beginning about their phone calls being intercepted. Did they ever, or do you have any evidence to think that they ever suspected their calls were being tapped?
They appear to have known about it from the very beginning.
Huh.
Now, in part, that's because everyone was recording everyone else at that time. The corpus of intercepts, not only telephone intercepts, but radio intercepts, throughout the wartime period that tell us a great deal about what has happened. And, of course, most of those have come into the custody now of the tribunal. And... Mm-hmm. have been admitted into evidence, and therefore are on the public record. They as they're talking with one another, they acknowledge that there may be someone listening, and develop little codes to remind one another that this is happening. But remarkably, it does not seem to have very much affected what they said to one another. The level of candor is astonishing in their conversation. And it just seems that they almost forgot about the fact that others were listening.
That is just amazing. So let me go back. What did Karadzic want to be the leader of the Serbs? Did he like the job?
He loved it. But when he was first being courted for it or considered for it, he at least pretended that he had no interest in it.
Hmm.
We believe that he did not seek to, he didn't really want it at first because he felt that it would take him away from his comfortable life as a practicing psychiatrist and also something of a literary figure in the Sarajevo. And involvement is, he detested politics, he always said. And he thought it would involve him in this kind of dirty business of day-to-day politics. But once he actually took the job on the, and there was a specific moment in time when he walked on stage and delivered his acceptance speech in July of 1991, from that moment on, he was an enthusiastic and, in fact, workaholic devotee of the Serbian national cause. And he became remarkably effective as a charismatic leader and an organizer of various activities that turned out, of course, to be so violent and despicable directed against other peoples.
So what kind of politician was he? What strengths did he bring to the job? What weaknesses did he have?
He was remarkably articulate. He had an innate sense of what appealed to people. He was the ultimate populist in that he could seem to be able to divine exactly what Serb nationalists or those who were prone to be nationalists wanted to hear from a leader. And he rarely drafted a speech in advance. Almost all of his speaking was spontaneous. But as you read those speeches, it comes out remarkably well organized and articulate. So he was tremendous at delivering motivating words to his followers and to structuring things so that people would understand events within the context that he wanted them to understand it in. So he was constantly referring to contemporary events, not only in Bosnia, but all over the world, and saying, look, this shows that the Serbs are being discriminated against, that our enemies are plotting against us, and we have to take action in order to defend ourselves and prevent them from doing these terrible things to us.
Did he rule, maybe not the right word, but autocratically? To what degree did he participate with the broader base of public or political opinion amongst the Bosnian Serbs?
That's, again, a very good question. I think the answer is that he avoided, whenever possible, autocratic rule. There's just no evidence he employed violence against other Serbs in order to get his way. Few instances we know of in which he had individuals singled out, but very few, very little violence associated with his rule. And in fact, he maintained the Bosnian Serb Assembly, consisting of 83 delegates who were elected in the 1990 election, throughout the war. And that group met 55 times during the war, and he always sought to respect his decisions in what he did. Now, he also sought to influence his decisions, and in a few cases, with the aid of some colleagues, he strong-armed decisions that it made. But by and large, he was a populist in the sense that he wanted to do things by broad consensus, rather than by autocratic methods.
So you write that in the autumn, I think it's September, if I remember right, of 1991, he underwent, and I've got a quote here, a personal and political metamorphosis. What happened and why did it happen?
Well, it's part of his political maturation. He had spent the first year of his time in office as leader of the Bosnian Serbs, as president of the Serb Democratic Party, largely responding to events and also responding to the leadership or mentorship that Milosevic gave to him. In the fall of 1991, he began to discover that reacting to events was leaving him powerless, that he could not control the direction of things and was simply getting lost in his anger and frustration at what the other, what he perceived as the other groups were doing to him. And overnight, and we really don't understand, at least I don't understand very well from the sources, exactly what sparked this transition. But he became a very careful, planning, calculating leader who was always thinking ahead several steps. If anything, it probably was the recognition that the option of remaining in Yugoslavia was dead. That happened on October 15, 1991, with the vote in the Parliament of Bosnia and Herzegovina. But it was foreshadowed by, for at least a month and a half, by other events which made that vote likely to turn out the way it did. So he began to realize that it was on his shoulders and his shoulders alone that the leadership of the Bosnian Serbs rested. So he changed styles radically, instantly, and effectively, which turned out to be something that he was able to do a number of times in his life, make these kind of instant radical changes in direction, even in tone, and even in persona, which was one of the keys to his effectiveness as a leader. He could turn these corners very quickly, and people would actually follow him and do what he hoped they would do in the way of carrying out his desires.
So in the aftermath of this, you say that he understands that, I don't know, the future or the fate or however you want to put it, of the Bosnian Serbs rests on him. How does he imagine that future in the fall of 1991?
It's very clear that he imagines this future as a Bosnia and Herzegovina devoid of all but Serbs. Or all but perhaps with a few elderly members of other groups still in existence. But people fantasize that they entertain fantasies of a mass destruction of non-Serbs, particularly of the Bosniaks, in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And he also planned that the Serbs would take over Bosnia one local community after the other. Is a very carefully and skillfully designed plan, and in the process assure Serb control and Serb habitation of those areas that were taken over. That was his vision of a Serb Bosnia and Herzegovina with very few non-Serbs in it and with political control exclusively in the hands of Serb nationalists who would follow, the course the mother republic, the Republic of Serbia, would follow.
And you start out the book by talking about how he's, as you suggested, he mixed socially with a variety of people. He seems to have no fundamental prejudice or at least no hatred of the Serbs. By this point, has that kind of emotional response to events emerged? Is he, I guess, racist is maybe the right term by that point?
It's probably a stretch to use the word racist, but in a sense, it's not wholly inappropriate to use it. The sense in which it's not perhaps quite right is that he came to detest and hate the leaders of the rival groups. When it came to the masses, his pronouncements and statements at that time, even in these telephone calls and in private conversations, were not so much a reflection of hatred as they were of, let's say, disregard and unconcern for their welfare, or for them. In other words, he was practicing studied neglect as a basis for doing these terrible things to them later on, rather than, let's say, the kind of intense, obsessive hatred that Hitler had for the Jews. And I concluded, looking at it, that in a sense, this indifference is perhaps in some respects more dangerous than the over-hatred in terms of a source of later violence. Because it is over-hatred is immediately telegraphed to people around the person who's aspiring to leadership on the basis of hatred. And that makes it extremely difficult, at least in normal situations, for that person to gain a lot of followers. But this neglect and indifference simply kind of flies by the populace and is not then really magnified in such a way as to draw attention to the dangers that the person presents.
Violence or war begin? What is the plan? What character does this war take? And how responsible was Krajicek in late 1991 and early 1992 for the nature of this warfare?
Well, the fact of the matter is that Krajicek's plan, and they weren't exclusively his plan, but the plans of the Bosnian Serb leadership were implemented to a T in the period from early April until about the end of July 1992. Mm-hmm. Bosnia was indeed taken over by local Serb leaders, one municipality at a time, always with the backing of the Yugoslav People's Army and local paramilitary forces, and of course, the party itself, the Serb Democratic Party. And that gave this war a peculiar quality. It was extremely violent, but it was also extremely localized in character. So a lot of responsibility fell upon these local leaders of the Serb Democratic Party, the SDS, to carry out these purges, expulsions, and even killings of local non-Serbs to purify their municipality of all but Serbs. That continued, as I say, for about the first 3 months of the war, and then began to assume the character of a more conventional war as those who were being driven out got better organized militarily and were able to put up some resistance. But that first phase of the war, during which the Bosnian Serbs conquered about 70% of Bosnia, was the time when many atrocities took place, when, in my view, the genocide actually commenced and resulted in the complete redrawing, if you will, of the map, the demographic map of Bosnia.
So, starting even before that violence, and then continuing on for the next couple years, 3 years, is this kind of parallel set of negotiations with Europeans and world leaders who are trying to broker some kind of peace settlement in the region. How did Krajicek see the people he was negotiating with, and how did these European and other leaders see him?
The negotiations began actually even before Krajicek showed up on the scene, with the intention of European community, now European Union, negotiators in June of 1991. But in the fall of 1991, Krajicek first became engaged in negotiations on behalf of the Bosnian Serbs, largely under Milosevic's tutelage. But by 1992, he was standing on his own two feet and had direct contacts and relations with international actors. The international actors always viewed him with some suspicion. He was a dynamic, charismatic, and rather large person. So he was definitely a factor to be reckoned with by all of the internationals. And they, in a sense, respected him for his, let's say, authority and authoritative manner. But they were always looking at what was happening on the ground and seeing that there was a great deal of gratuitous violence going on, that human rights were being violated. And they could never pin him down, that is, pin Krajicek down, to actually promise and fulfill his promises to end that violence. So very quickly, the international viewed him with suspicion and eventually with, let's say, seeing him as an evil and faithless negotiator. On the other hand, Karadzic, I think, always underestimated the authority that the internationals brought to the table. He was, in his private communications, generally disparaging of the people that sat across the table from him, and contemptuous, in particular, of the German and American diplomats who he thought were always committed to try and get revenge against Serbs.
During this period, was there ever any real chance of a deal?
I think there was. But the demands, the expectations that the Serbs had, based on their backing by the Yugoslav People's Army and the extravagant sense of the claims that they prosecuted, really made it difficult for them to accept the possibility of a compromise arrangement. And on the other hand, the other two parties to the conflict, the Croats and the Bosniaks, themselves had very high expectations and felt themselves being crowded by the Serbs and found themselves unable to accept the demands that the Serbs were making in the negotiations. So it really came down to a situation where one side had the confidence that it would be backed militarily by the Yugoslav People's Army, and the other side realizing that they would have to fight in order to prevent a conquest, a political conquest, in a sense, of the Serbs of all of Yugoslavia.
And then in early 95, the strategic situation changes, as I read your book, with the Bosnian Serb forces beginning to see reverses. How does Karadzic respond to that?
Indeed, we have jumped over a great deal of strategic change when moving to 1995.
And feel free to summarize that if you want.
Yes, but I think it's justified to do that. The Bosniaks and the Croats had, in the meantime, fought a war, which was a bloody war and a very violent time. But owing to U.S. intervention, they patched up those differences in early 1994 and again become allies. Certainly not good friends, but were at least coordinating some of their battlefield efforts against the Serbs. And in the early spring of 1995, those efforts, particularly by the Croat forces, but also by the Bosniaks, produced for the first real victories over Serb forces on the battlefield. This spread panic through the entire Bosnian Serb leadership. And Karadzic, who was not particularly prone to panic, was also caught up in concern for the conquest that they were seeking to defend and hoped to at least stem the tide without having to go to extreme lengths to reconquer the area. So as the international involvement deepened and the Croat and Bosniak forces advanced, Karadzic and his immediate allies in the leadership adopted a very high-risk strategy trying to essentially provoke the international actors so that they would experience sufficient humiliation and losses that the public of the contributing countries to this United Nations force would withdraw their soldiers. Well, that took place in the May, June, July period, but it really, in the final analysis, did not work. And it was nonetheless the decision of Carthage to try to settle the scores once and for all in eastern Bosnia, that area closest to the Republic of Serbia, and to secure a purely Serb area in Bosnia, devoid of virtually any non-Serbs, as a definitive act. And that is the background to what became the best-known genocide of the war, which is the conquest in mid-July 1995 of the community of Srebrenica in eastern Bosnia, and the slaughter of about 8,000 mainly men from that community in the period of July 11th to 15th.
That's actually where I was going to go. And so what was Karadzic's role in the decision to slaughter those people?
Yes, he is the one who jumped the command, in a sense, and actually went out to a military headquarters in eastern Bosnia, and as commander-in-chief, directed one of the subordinate generals out there to prepare a plan to attack and conquer Srebrenica. He wanted it done as soon as possible. And so the initiative to take the city came from Karadzic, and he took that step in the full knowledge that the conquest of the city was likely to end in the slaughter of many of its, if not all of its, Muslim residents. However, he was not the one on the ground who actually directed the specific slaughter and the means that were used to exterminate these people to commit the genocide in July. That was the role of General Ratko Mladic, who was the overall commander of the Bosnian Serb forces, who, in a sense, took up where Karadzic left off when he finally got there and took command of things on the ground. Karadzic remained deeply involved, extremely well briefed upon these measures, supported everything that Mladic was ordering to be done, and defended it all afterwards, and in fact claimed credit for having orchestrated the slaughter, the genocide at Srebrenica. But there was a handoff, in a sense, of leadership for the slaughter itself in the middle of July when Mladic arrived on the scene.
That's a remarkable statement that he later claimed credit. Is there any, and I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit, we'll come back to the story, but is there any sense that in his later years he ever came to regret that decision or to feel like he had either done something poorly, I guess politically, but more ethically?
I have to say that discovering these speeches that were made to the Bosnian Serb Assembly in the aftermath of the Srebrenica genocide was about the most chilling thing that I came across in the course of this entire research. And some of it actually preceded the killings in Srebrenica, but it continued in a couple of sessions after the genocide, in which he and the generals, not, it wasn't Mladic personally, but the generals of the Serbian army were competing with one another to claim credit for having carried out these murders. The speeches by Karadzic are filled with extravagant claims that he had ordered this. He identifies the specific orders that he issued, and he identifies other orders that he did not issue. But demands, insists that he was responsible for these killings as a point of pride, as of being the, in a sense, bravest serve of them all, the most adamant in prosecuting these plans that he laid some 4 years, 5 years ago before. And the record is devoid of any sense of regret or remorse on the part of Karadzic at any point thereafter, including during trial or the various interviews and statements that he made between the time that he was finished the was removed as president and the time that his trial was over, which was just a few weeks ago. Remarkable absence of any introspective reconsideration of his responsibility for these things and remorse for the decisions that he made. He seems to have simply been incapable psychologically of reviewing his own actions and reflecting critically upon them.
So you mentioned then that he fell out of favor, at least with Milosevic, and then out of power shortly after that. What happened that he gets outmaneuvered and edged out of power?
Milosevic decided sometime in about 1993 that the war should end. The main reason that he wanted the war to end was that the Western powers, through the United Nations, had imposed severe sanctions on the Republic of Serbia itself. And those sanctions were crippling Serbia, they were crippling the everyday life of Serbs, and most importantly, they were threatening Milosevic's hold on power. So he tried to persuade the Bosnian Serbs and persuade Karadzic to agree to a peace negotiated by international diplomats. And he failed. He used increasing pressure and means of persuasion to get them to do this. But in the final analysis, it came down to the fact that he decided to remove the leadership of the Bosnian Serbs, not from power completely, but from any role in negotiating a peace. And that's when, and that took place just in a month after Srebrenica, after the Srebrenica genocide, basically Milosevic put himself at the head of the delegation that negotiated the peace agreement, or end of the war at Dayton.
Well, we're running out of time, but I've got to ask you, because it's such an astonishing story. He's indicted by the ICTY in 1995, and he's not captured for years afterwards. How does he avoid capture for so long?
That may be the most intriguing part of his life. He was incredibly resourceful, and he was capable of making these radical changes of personality and even appearance that led him to move to Belgrade and take up a life in disguise as a psychic healer under the David Davich. He grew his hair, which was long and wavy, of course, during the war and before the war, but he grew it to considerable length. He grew a long, thick beard and put on a pair of thick glasses or thick-looking glasses. He dressed himself in kind of new wave attire that made him look more like a medicinal healer than a normal civilian person. And he then successfully evaded those seeking him until finally he assumed too public a role as a faith healer. He began to actually become popular, making TV and radio appearances, and someone recognized his voice and reported it to the authorities. And right at the time that there was a change of government in Serbia and a government that was prepared to hand him over, actually went out and arrested him and had him immediately transported to The Hague for indictment and eventual trial.
It's a remarkable story. You have a picture of him in his, I don't know, a disguise is maybe not the right word, but with his new personality and new identity. And my 8-year-old daughter yesterday, when I was preparing for this, was trying to avoid going to bed and was asking me questions about the book. And I was trying to answer them in a way that's appropriate for an 8-year-old. And I finally hit on the idea of showing her the picture on the cover with Karadzic kind of in his prime as a political leader, and then showing her the picture of him in his new identity. And she said, what I get the sense everybody else did is that doesn't look like the same person.
And indeed, it did not for anyone who came to know him. He quietly sat in a bar underneath his own picture, a picture of him, and was unrecognized by the bar patrons and I thought one of the great ironies of this was that when he tells the story of getting along with all these different people in Sarajevo prior to 1990, he always refers to the barber that he went to, whose name was Michal, which is a nickname for him. Now, that's a Muslim name. And The one thing that he obviously did not take advantage of in Belgrade was a barber. Or a beard trim in several years. So it appears that he was only going to respond to a Muslim barber rather than a Serb one.
Oh, my. Well, it's a remarkable story and very well told. We've taken a lot of your time here, so just a couple kind of concluding questions that are typical of this. And so first, I'm wondering if you have a recommendation for people who are interested in the subject, whether it's the war in Bosnia or the Balkans more generally. Do you have a book that you would recommend they read, something that either you find personally meaningful or really highly instructive?
There actually are a couple of these new books that I mentioned earlier that I would consider worthy. One is a book by Edita Bacirovic called Genocide on the Drina River, which is a graphic account of the events in eastern Bosnia in 1992 by a woman who was a reporter throughout the war and who had many excellent informants in the area, and writes a graphic and indeed chilling account of that took place in that part of Bosnia and essentially exterminated the non-Serb population. I have a suggestion for a movie. It's going to sound unusual, but it's The Act of Killing, which is a movie about Indonesia and the killings of over a million communists or communist sympathizers in 1965 to 1966. And the reason I suggest it is that it shows a society that has never come to terms with the genocidal killings that were done by some of its citizens against others. It's very difficult to see the end of this movie. It's so sickening. But I think it's an important movie for a film for all of us to see, just to get an idea of what can happen, how grotesque life can become when these things are not coped with, when they're not actually reckoned with in the form of some sort of transitional justice or post-conflict reconciliation.
Hmm. Well, I now have more to do this weekend, and I will go off and read and watch. Do you have a project you're working on now?
Well, I'm working on trying to represent to people the evolution of the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague and the various decisions that were made by the judges in that case, the people who came before the court, and the way in which their deeds were documented. So I'm looking, in a sense, at the procedures and the process whereby we have come to know what happened during that war, how the process succeeded when it did, and ways in which it did not succeed, as a kind of a guide to future courts or tribunals, which of course would be mainly the International Criminal Court, in dealing with other situations of mass violence.
I have to say, that sounds like a fascinating project, and I hope when you're done, you'll think about coming back on the show. But for today, I just want to say thank you so much. It was wonderful and great to talk to you.
Well, thank you, and it was good to be with you, and I thank you for your excellent questions.
You've been listening to an interview with Bob Donier about his book, Radovan Karadzic, Architect of the Bosnian Genocide. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I talk with Irvin Staub about his comprehensive new book, Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. In the meantime, thanks for the download and have a great month.